Hospital? Must have, she says grimly. As I hurry toward the ladders at the far end of the warehouse, the sight of Masala and one of the insects emerging from behind an air duct surprises me. I thought they'd still be hunkered down in the alley.
They're growing on me, says Gale.
I scramble down a ladder. When my feet hit the ground, I find a bodyguard, Cressida, and the other insect waiting. I expect resistance, but Cressida just waves me toward the hospital. She's yelling, I don't care, Plutarch. Just give me 5 more minutes. Not one to question a free pass, I take off into the street.
Oh, no,
I whisper as I catch sight of the hospital. What used to be the hospital. I move past the wounded, past the burning plane wrecks, fixated on the disaster ahead of me, people screaming, running about frantically, but unable to help. The bombs have collapsed the hospital roof and set the building on fire, effectively trapping the patients within. A group of rescuers has assembled, trying to clear a path to the inside, but I already know what they will find. If the crushing debris and the flames didn't get them, the smoke did. Gale's at my shoulder. The fact that he does nothing only confirms my suspicions. Miners don't abandon an accident until it's hopeless. Come on, Katniss. Haymitch says they can get a hovercraft in for us now, he tells me. But I can't seem to move. Why would they do that? Why would they target people who were already dying? I ask him.
Scare others off. Prevent the wounded from seeking help, says Gale. Those people you met, they were expendable. To Snow, anyway. If the capital wins, what will they do with a bunch of damaged slaves?
I remember all those years in the woods, listening to Gale rant against the capital. Me, not paying close attention, wondering why he even bothered to dissect its motives. Why thinking like our enemy would ever matter? Clearly, it could have mattered today. When Gale questioned the existence of the hospital, he was not thinking of disease, but this. Because he never underestimates the cruelty of those we face. I slowly turn my back to the hospital and find Cressida, flanked by the insects, standing a couple of yards in front of me, her manners unrattled, cool even. Katniss, she says. President Snow just had them air the bombing live. Then he made an appearance to say that this was his way of sending a message to the rebels. What about you? Would you like to tell the rebels anything?
Yes,
I whisper.
The red blinking light on one of the cameras catches my eye. I know I'm being recorded.
Yes, I say more forcefully. Everyone is drawing away from me. Gale, Cressida, the insects, giving me the stage. But I stay focused on the red light. I want to tell the rebels that I am alive, that I'm right here in District 8, where the Capitol has just bombed a hospital full of unarmed men, women, and children. There will be no survivors.
The shock I've been feeling begins to give way to fury.
I want to tell people that if you think for 1 second the Capitol will treat us fairly if there's a ceasefire, you're deluding yourself, because you know who they are and what they do.
My hands go out automatically, as if to indicate the whole horror around me.
This is what they do, and we must fight back.
I'm moving in toward the camera now, carried forward by my rage.
President Snow says he's sending us a message. Well, I have one for him. You can torture us and bomb us and burn our districts to the ground. But do you see that?
One of the cameras follows as I point to the planes burning on the roof of the warehouse across from us. The Capitol seal on the wing glows clearly through the flames.
Fire is catching!
I am shouting now, determined that he will not miss a word.
And if we burn, you burn with us.
My last words hang in the air. I feel suspended in time, held aloft in a cloud of heat that generates not from my surroundings, but from my own being.
Cut!
Cressida's voice snaps me back to reality,
extinguishes me. She gives me a nod of approval. That's a wrap! Chapter 8. Boggs appears and gets a firm lock on my arm, but I'm not planning on running now. I look over at the hospital, just in time to see the rest of the structure give way, and the fight goes out of me. All those people, the hundreds of wounded, the relatives, the medics from 13, are no more. I turn back to Boggs, see the swelling on his face left by Gale's boot. I'm no expert, but I'm pretty sure his nose is broken. His voice is more resigned than angry, though. Back to the landing strip. I obediently take a step forward and wince as I become aware of the pain behind my right knee. The adrenaline rush that overrode the sensation has passed, and my body parts join in a chorus of complaints. I'm banged up and bloody, and someone seems to be hammering on my left temple from inside my skull. Boggs quickly examines my face, then scoops me up and jogs for the runway. Halfway there, I puke on his bulletproof vest. It's hard to tell because he's short of breath, but I think he sighs. A small hovercraft, different from the one that transported us here, waits on the runway. The second my team's on board, we take off. No comfy seats and windows this time. We seem to be in some sort of cargo craft. Boggs does emergency first aid on people to hold them until we get back to 13. I want to take off my vest, since I got a fair amount of vomit on it as well, but it's too cold to think about it. I lie on the floor with my head in Gale's lap. The last thing I remember is Boggs spreading a couple of burlap sacks over me. When I wake up, I'm warm and patched up in my old bed in the hospital. My mother's there, checking my vital signs. How do you feel? A little beat up, but all right, I say. No one even told us you were going until you were gone, she says. I feel a pang of guilt. When your families had to send you off twice to the Hunger Games, this isn't the kind of detail you should overlook. I'm sorry. They weren't expecting the attack. I was just supposed to be visiting the patients, I explain. Next time, I'll have them clear it with you. Katniss, no one clears anything with me, she says. It's true. Even I don't. Not since my father died. Why pretend? Well, I'll have them notify you anyway. On the bedside table is a piece of shrapnel they removed from my leg. The doctors are more concerned with the damage my brain might have suffered from the explosions, since my concussion hadn't fully healed to begin with. But I don't have double vision or anything, and I can think clearly enough. I've slept right through the late afternoon and night, and I'm starving. My breakfast is disappointingly small, just a few cubes of bread soaking in warm milk. I've been called down to an early morning meeting at command. I start to get up and then realize they plan to roll my hospital bed directly there. I want to walk, but that's out, so I negotiate my way into a wheelchair. I feel fine, really, except for my head and my leg and the soreness from the bruises and the nausea that hit a couple minutes after I ate. Maybe the wheelchair's a good idea. As they wheel me down, I begin to get uneasy about what I will face. Gale and I directly disobeyed orders yesterday, and Boggs has the injury to prove it. Surely there will be repercussions, but will they go so far as coin annulling our agreement for the victor's immunity? Have I stripped PETA of what little protection I could give him? When I get to command, the only ones who've arrived are Cressida, Masala, and the insects. Masala beams and says, "There's our little star!" And the others are smiling so genuinely that I can't help but smile in return. They impressed me in 8, following me onto the roof during the bombing, making Plutarch back off so they could get the footage they wanted. They more than do their work. They take pride in it, like Cinna. I have a strange thought that if we were in the arena together, I would pick them as allies, Cressida, Masala, and... I have to stop calling you the insects, I blurt out to the cameramen. I explain how I didn't know their names, but their suits suggested the shelled creatures. The comparison doesn't seem to bother them. Even without the camera shells, they strongly resemble each other. Same sandy hair, red beards, and blue eyes. The one with close-bitten nails introduces himself as Castor, and the other, who's his brother, as Pollux. I wait for Pollux to say hello, but he just nods. At first I think he's shy or a man of few words, but something tugs on me, the position of his lips, the extra effort he takes to swallow, and I know before Castor tells me, Pollux is an Avox. They have cut out his tongue and he will never speak again. And I no longer have to wonder what made him risk everything to help bring down the capital. As the room fills, I brace myself for a less congenial reception. But the only people who register any kind of negativity are Haymitch, who's always out of sorts, and a sour-faced Fulvia Cardew. Boggs wears a flesh-colored plastic mask from his upper lip to his brow. I was right about the broken nose. So his expression's hard to read. Coyne and Gale are in the midst of some exchange that seems positively chummy. When Gale slides into the seat next to my wheelchair, I say, "Making new friends?" His eyes flicker to the president and back. "Well, one of us has to be accessible." He touches my temple gently. "How do you feel?" They must have served stewed garlic and squash for the breakfast vegetable. The more people who gather, the stronger the fumes are. My stomach turns, and the lights suddenly seem too bright. "Kind of rocky," I say. "How are you?" "Fine. They dug out a couple of pieces of shrapnel. No big deal," he says. Coyne calls the meeting to order. "Our airtime assault has officially launched. For any of you who missed yesterday's 20-hundred broadcast of our first propo, or the 17 reruns Beatty has managed to air since, we will begin by replaying it." Replaying it? So they not only got usable footage, they've already slapped together a propo and aired it repeatedly? My palms grow moist in anticipation of seeing myself on television. What if I'm still awful? What if I'm as stiff and pointless as I was in the studio, and they've just given up on getting anything better? Individual screens slide up from the table. The lights dim slightly, and a hush falls over the room. At first, my screen is black. Then a tiny spark flickers in the center. It blossoms, spreads, silently eating up the blackness until the entire frame is ablaze with a fire so real and intense, I imagine I feel the heat emanating from it. The image of my Mockingjay pin emerges, glowing red gold. The deep, resonant voice that haunts my dreams begins to speak. Claudius Templesmith, the official announcer of the Hunger Games, says, "Katniss Everdeen, the girl who was on fire, burns on!" Suddenly, there I am, replacing the Mockingjay, standing before the real flames and smoke of District 8. I want to tell the rebels that I am alive, that I'm right here in District 8, where the Capitol has just bombed a hospital full of unarmed men, women, and children. There will be no survivors. Cut to the hospital collapsing in on itself, the desperation of the onlookers as I continue in voiceover. I want to tell people that if you think for one second the Capitol will treat us fairly, if there's a ceasefire, you're deluding yourself, because you know who they are and what they do. Back to me now, my hands lifting up to indicate the outrage around me. This is what they do, and we must fight back. Now comes a truly fantastic montage of the battle. The initial bombs falling, us running, being blown to the ground. A close-up on my wound, which looks good and bloody. Scaling the roof, diving into the nests, and then some amazing shots of the rebels, Gale, and mostly me, knocking those planes out of the sky, smash cut back to me, moving in on the camera. President Snow says he's sending us a message. Well, I have one for him. You can torture us and bomb us and burn our districts to the ground, but do you see that? We're with the camera, tracking to the planes burning on the roof of the warehouse, tight on the Capitol seal on a wing, which melts back into the image of my face, shouting at the president, "Fire is catching, and if we burn, you burn with us." Flames engulf the screen again. Superimposed on them in black, solid letters are the words, "If we burn, you burn with us." The words catch fire and the whole screen burns to blackness. There's a moment of silent relish, then applause followed by demands to see it again. Coin indulgently hits the replay button, and this time, since I know what will happen, I try to pretend that I'm watching this on my television at home in the seam. An anti-capital statement. There's never been anything like it on television, not in my lifetime anyway. By the time the screen burns to black a second time, I need to know more. Did it play all over Panem? Did they see it in the Capitol?
"Not in the Capitol," says Plutarch. "We couldn't override their system, although BD's working on it. But in all the districts, we even got it on in two, which may be more valuable than the Capitol at this point in the game."
"Is Claudius Temple Smith with us?" I ask. This gives Plutarch a good laugh.
"Only his voice. But that's ours for the taking. We didn't even have to do any special editing. He said that actual line in your first games."
He slaps his hand on the table.
"What say we give another round of applause to Cressida, her amazing team, and, of course, our on-camera talent?"
I clap, too, until I realize I'm the on-camera talent, and maybe it's obnoxious that I'm applauding for myself, but no one's paying attention. I can't help noticing the strain on Fulvia's face, though. I think how hard this must be for her, watching Haymitch's idea succeed under Cressida's direction, when Fulvia's studio approach was such a flop. Coin seems to have reached the end of her tolerance for self-congratulation.
"Yes, well deserved. The result is more than we had hoped for. But I do have to question the wide margin of risk that you were willing to operate within. I know the raid was unforeseen. However, given the circumstances, I think we should discuss the decision to send Katniss into actual combat."
"The decision? To send me into combat? Then she doesn't know that I flagrantly disregarded orders, ripped out my earpiece, and gave my bodyguards the slip? What else have they kept from her?"
"It was a tough call," says Plutarch, furrowing his brow, "but the general consensus was that we weren't going to get anything worth using if we locked her in a bunker somewhere every time a gun went off." "And you're all right with that?" asks the president. Gail has to kick me under the table before I realize that she's talking to me.
"Oh, yeah, I'm completely all right with that. It felt good, doing something for a change."
"Well, let's be just a little more judicious with her exposure, especially now that the Capitol knows what she can do," says Coin. There's a rumble of assent from around the table.
No one has ratted out Gail and me, not Plutarch, whose authority we ignored, not Boggs, with his broken nose, not the insects we led into fire. Not Haymitch. No, wait a minute. Haymitch is giving me a deadly smile and saying sweetly,
"Yeah, we wouldn't want to lose our little mockingjay when she's finally begun to sing."
I make a note to myself not to end up alone in a room with him, because he's clearly having vengeful thoughts over that stupid earpiece.
"So, what else do you have planned?" asks the president.
Plutarch nods to Cressida, who consults a clipboard. "We have some terrific footage of Katniss at the hospital in 8. There should be another propo in that with the theme, because you know who they are and what they do. We'll focus on Katniss interacting with the patients, particularly the children, the bombing of the hospital, and the wreckage. Masala's cutting that together. We're also thinking about a Mockingjay piece. Highlight some of Katniss's best moments, intercut with scenes of rebel uprisings and war footage. We call that one Fire is Catching. And then Fulvia came up with a really brilliant idea." Fulvia's mouthful of sour grapes expression is startled right off her face, but she recovers.
"Well, I don't know how brilliant it is, but I was thinking we could do a series of propos called We Remember, and each one we would feature one of the dead tributes, Little Rue from 11, or old Mags from 4, the idea being that we could target each district with a very personal piece.
A tribute to your tributes, as it were, says Plutarch.
That is brilliant, Fulvia, I say sincerely. It's the perfect way to remind people why they're fighting.
I think it could work, she says. I thought we might use Finnick to intro and narrate the spots, if there was interest in them.
Frankly, I don't see how we could have too many We Remember propos, says Coyne. Can you start producing them today?
Of course, says Fulvia, obviously mollified by the response to her idea. Cressida has smoothed everything over in the creative department with her gesture, praised Fulvia for what is, in fact, a really good idea, and cleared the way to continue her own on-air depiction of the Mockingjay. What's interesting is that Plutarch seems to have no need to share in the credit. All he wants is for the airtime assault to work. I remember that Plutarch is a head game maker, not a member of the crew, not a piece in the games. Therefore, his worth is not defined by a single element, but by the overall success of the production. If we win the war, that's when Plutarch will take his bow and expect his reward. The president sends everyone off to get to work, so Gail wheels me back to the hospital. We laugh a little about the cover-up. Gail says no one wanted to look bad by admitting they couldn't control us. I'm kinder, saying they probably didn't want to jeopardize the chance of taking us out again now that they've gotten some decent footage. Both things are probably true. Gail has to go meet Beatty down in special weaponry, so I doze off. It seems like I've only shut my eyes for a few minutes, but when I open them, I flinch at the sight of Haymitch sitting a couple of feet from my bed, waiting, possibly for several hours, if the clock is right. I think about hollering for a witness, but I'm going to have to face him sooner or later. Haymitch leans forward and dangles something on a thin white wire in front of my nose. It's hard to focus on, but I'm pretty sure what it is. He drops it to the sheets.
That is your earpiece.
I will give you exactly one more chance to wear it. If you remove it from your ear again, I'll have you fitted with this. He holds up some sort of metal headgear that I instantly name the head shackle. It's an alternative audio unit that locks around your skull and under your chin until it's opened with a key. And I'll have the only key. If for some reason you're clever enough to disable it... Haymitch dumps the head shackle on the bed and whips out a tiny silver chip. I'll authorize them to surgically implant this transmitter into your ear so that I may speak to you 24 hours a day. Haymitch in my head full-time, horrifying. I'll keep the earpiece in, I mutter.
Excuse me, he says.
I'll keep the earpiece in, I say, loud enough to wake up half the hospital.
You sure?
Because I'm equally happy with any of the three options, he tells me. I'm sure, I say. I scrunch up the earpiece wire protectively in my fist and fling the head shackle back in his face with my free hand, but he catches it easily, probably was expecting me to throw it. Anything else? Haymitch rises to go. While I was waiting, I ate your lunch. My eyes take in the empty stew bowl and tray on my bed table. I'm going to report you, I mumble into my pillow.
You do that, sweetheart.
He goes out, safe in the knowledge that I'm not the reporting kind. I want to go back to sleep, but I'm restless. Images from yesterday begin to flood into the present. The bombing, the fiery plane crashes, the faces of the wounded who no longer exist. I imagine death from all sides. The last moment before seeing a shell hit the ground, feeling the wing blown from my plane and the dizzying nosedive into oblivion, the warehouse roof falling down at me while I'm pinned helplessly to my cot. Things I saw, in person or on the tape. Things I caused with a pull of my bowstring.
things I will never be able to erase from my memory. At dinner, Vinnick brings his tray to my bed so we can watch the newest propo together on television. He was assigned quarters on my old floor, but he has so many mental relapses, he still basically lives in the hospital. The rebels air the "because you know who they are and what they do" propo that Masala edited. The footage is intercut with short studio clips of Gale, Boggs, and Cressida describing the incident. It's hard to watch my reception in the hospital in 8, since I know what's coming. When the bombs rain down on the roof, I bury my face in my pillow, looking up again at a brief clip of me at the end, after all the victims are dead. At least Vinnick doesn't applaud or act all happy when it's done. He just says, "People should know that happened, and now they do." "Let's turn it off, Vinnick, before they run it again," I urge him. But as Finnick's hand moves toward the remote control, I cry, "Wait! The Capitol is introducing a special segment, and something about it looks familiar. Yes, it's Caesar Flickerman, and I can guess who his guest will be." Peeta's physical transformation shocks me. The healthy, clear-eyed boy I saw a few days ago has lost at least 15 pounds and developed a nervous tremor in his hands. They've still got him groomed, but underneath the paint that cannot cover the bags under his eyes and the fine clothes that cannot conceal the pain he feels when he moves is a person badly damaged. My mind reels, trying to make sense of it. I just saw him, 4, no, 5, I think it was 5 days ago. How has he deteriorated so rapidly? What could they possibly have done to him in such a short time? Then it hits me. I replay in my mind as much as I can of his first interview with Caesar, searching for anything that would place it in time. There is nothing. They could have taped that interview a day or two after I blew up the arena, then done whatever they wanted to do to him ever since. "Oh, Peeta," I whisper. Caesar and Peeta have a few empty exchanges before Caesar asks him about rumors that I'm taping propos for the districts. "They're using her, obviously," says Peeta, "to whip up the rebels. I doubt she even really knows what's going on in the war, what's at stake, what the risks are to her personally. They're probably hoping she gets knocked off so they can turn her into some kind of martyr."
"Is there anything you'd like to tell her?" asks Caesar.
"There is," says Peeta. He looks directly into the camera, right into my eyes. "Don't be a fool, Katniss. Think for yourself. They've turned you into a weapon that could be instrumental in the destruction of humanity. If you've got any real influence, use it to put the brakes on this thing. Use it to stop the war before it's too late. Ask yourself, do you really trust the people you're working with? Do you really know what's going on? And if you don't, find out." Black screen. Seal of Panem. Show over. Vinnick presses the button on the remote that kills the power. In a minute, people will be here to do damage control on Peeta's condition and the words that came out of his mouth. I will need to repudiate them, but the truth is, I don't trust the rebels, or Plutarch, or Coyne. I'm not confident that they tell me the truth. I won't be able to conceal this. Footsteps are approaching. Vinnick grips me hard by the arms.
"We didn't see it."
"What?" I ask.
"We didn't see Peeta. Only the propo on 8. Then we turned the set off because the images upset you. Got it?"
he asks. I nod.
"Finish your dinner."
I pull myself together enough so that when Plutarch and Fulvia enter, I have a mouthful of bread and cabbage. Vinnick is talking about how well Gale came across on camera. We congratulate them on the propo. Make it clear it was so powerful, we tuned out right afterward. They look relieved. They believe us. No one mentions Peeta.
Chapter 9. I stop trying to sleep after my first few attempts are interrupted by unspeakable nightmares. After that, I just lie still and do fake breathing whenever someone checks on me. In the morning, I'm released from the hospital and instructed to take it easy. Cressida asks me to record a few lines for a new Mockingjay propo. At lunch, I keep waiting for people to bring up Peeta's appearance, but no one does. Someone must have seen it besides Finnick and me. I have training, but Gail's scheduled to work with Beatty on weapons or something, so I get permission to take Finnick to the woods. We wander around a while, and then ditch our communicators under a bush. When we're a safe distance away, we sit and discuss Peeta's broadcast.
I haven't heard one word about it. No one's told you anything? Finnick says.
I shake my head. He pauses before he asks,
Not even Gail?
I'm clinging to a shred of hope that Gail honestly knows nothing about Peeta's message, but I have a bad feeling he does.
Maybe he's trying to find a time to tell you privately.
Maybe, I say. We stay silent so long that a buck wanders into range. I take it down with an arrow. Finnick hauls it back to the fence. For dinner, there's minced venison in the stew. Gail walks me back to compartment E after we eat. When I ask him what's been going on, again there's no mention of Peeta. As soon as my mother and sister are asleep, I slip the pearl from the drawer and spend a second sleepless night clutching it in my hand, replaying Peeta's words in my head. Ask yourself, do you really trust the people you're working with? Do you really know what's going on? And if you don't, find out.
Find out? What? From who? And how can Peeta know anything except what the Capitol tells him?
It's just a Capitol propo. More noise. But if Plutarch thinks it's just the Capitol line, why didn't he tell me about it? Why hasn't anyone let me or Finnick know?
Under this debate lies the real source of my distress. Peeta. What have they done to him? And what are they doing to him right now? Clearly Snow did not buy the story that Peeta and I knew nothing about the rebellion, and his suspicions have been reinforced now that I have come out as the Mockingjay. Peeta can only guess about the rebel tactics, or make up things to tell his torturers. Lies, once discovered, would be severely punished. How abandoned by me he must feel. In his first interview, he tried to protect me from the Capitol and rebels alike, and not only have I failed to protect him, I've brought down more horrors upon him. Come morning, I stick my forearm in the wall and stare groggily at the day's schedule. Immediately after breakfast, I am slated for production. In the dining hall, as I down my hot grain and milk and mushy beets, I spot a communicuff on Gail's wrist.
When did you get that back, Soldier Hawthorne? I ask.
Yesterday. They thought if I'm going to be in the field with you, it could be a backup system of communication, says Gail.
No one has ever offered me a communicuff. I wonder if I asked for one, would I get it?
Well, I guess one of us has to be accessible, I say with an edge to my voice.
What's that mean? He says.
Nothing, just repeating what you said, I tell him, and I totally agree that the accessible one should be you. I just hope I still have access to you as well.
Our eyes lock, and I realize how furious I am with Gail. That I don't believe for a second that he didn't see Peeta's propo, that I feel completely betrayed that he didn't tell me about it. We know each other too well for him not to read my mood and guess what has caused it.
Katniss, he begins. Already the admission of guilt is in his tone.
I grab my tray, cross to the deposit area, and slam the dishes onto the rack. By the time I'm in the hallway, he's caught up with me.
Why didn't you say something? He asks, taking my arm.
Why didn't I? I jerk my arm free. Why didn't you, Gail? And I did, by the way, when I asked you last night about what had been going on.
I'm sorry, all right? I didn't know what to do. I wanted to tell you, but everyone was afraid that seeing Peeta's propo would make you sick, he says.
They were right. It did. But not quite as sick as you lying to me for coin. At that moment, his communicuff starts beeping.
There she is.
Better run. You have things to tell her.
For a moment, real hurt registers on his face. Then cold anger replaces it. He turns on his heel and goes. Maybe I've been too spiteful, not given him enough time to explain. Maybe everyone is just trying to protect me by lying to me. I don't care. I'm sick of people lying to me for my own good. Because really, it's mostly for their own good. Lie to Katniss about the rebellion so she doesn't do anything crazy. Send her into the arena without a clue so we can fish her out. Don't tell her about Peeta's propo because it might make her sick, and it's hard enough to get a decent performance out of her as it is.
I do feel sick, heartsick, and too tired for a day of production. But I'm already at remake, so I go in.
Today, I discover, we will be returning to District 12. Cressida wants to do unscripted interviews with Gale and me, throwing light on our demolished city.
If you're both up for that,
says Cressida, looking closely at my face.
Count me in,
I say. I stand, uncommunicative and stiff, a mannequin, as my prep team dresses me, does my hair, and dabs makeup on my face. Not enough to show, only enough to take the edge off the circles under my sleepless eyes. Boggs escorts me down to the hangar, but we don't talk beyond a preliminary greeting. I'm grateful to be spared another exchange about my disobedience in 8, especially since his mask looks so uncomfortable. At the last moment, I remember to send a message to my mother about my leaving 13, and stress that it won't be dangerous. We board a hovercraft for the short ride to 12, and I'm directed to a seat at a table where Plutarch, Gale, and Cressida are poring over a map. Plutarch's brimming with satisfaction as he shows me the before and after effects of the first couple of propos. The rebels, who were barely maintaining a foothold in several districts, have rallied. They have actually taken 3 and 11, the latter so crucial since it's Panem's main food supplier, and have made inroads in several other districts as well.
Hopeful, very hopeful indeed, says Plutarch. Fulvia's going to have the first round of We Remember spots ready tonight, so we can target the individual districts with their dead. Finnick's absolutely marvelous.
It's painful to watch, actually, says Cressida. He knew so many of them personally.
That's what makes it so effective, says Plutarch, straight from the heart. You're all doing beautifully. Coin could not be more pleased.
Gale didn't tell them, then, about my pretending not to see Peeta and my anger at their cover-up. But I guess it's too little too late, because I still can't let it go. It doesn't matter. He's not speaking to me, either. It's not until we land in the meadow that I realize Haymitch isn't among our company. When I ask Plutarch about his absence, he shakes his head and says,
"He couldn't face it."
Haymitch? Not able to face something?
Wanted a day off, more likely, I say. I think his actual words were, "I couldn't face it without a bottle," says Plutarch.
I roll my eyes, long out of patience with my mentor, his weakness for drink, and what he can or can't confront. But about 5 minutes after my return to 12, I'm wishing I had a bottle myself. I thought I'd come to terms with 12's demise, heard of it, seen it from the air, and wandered through its ashes. So why does everything bring on a fresh pang of grief? Was I simply too out of it before to fully register the loss of my world? Or is it the look on Gale's face as he takes in the destruction on foot that makes the atrocity feel brand new? Cressida directs the team to start with me at my old house. I ask her what she wants me to do.
Whatever you feel like, she says.
Standing back in my kitchen, I don't feel like doing anything. In fact, I find myself focusing up at the sky, the only roof left, because too many memories are drowning me. After a while, Cressida says,
That's fine, Katniss. Let's move on.
Gale doesn't get off so easily at his old address. Cressida films him in silence for a few minutes,
But just as he pulls the one remnant of his previous life from the ashes, a twisted metal poker, she starts to question him about his family, his job, life in the seam. She makes him go back to the night of the firebombing and reenact it, starting at his house, working his way down across the meadow and through the woods to the lake. I straggle behind the film crew and the bodyguards, feeling their presence to be a violation of my beloved woods. This is a private place, a sanctuary already corrupted by the capital's evil. Even after we've left behind the charred stumps near the fence, we're still tripping over decomposing bodies. Do we have to record it for everyone to see? By the time we reach the lake, Gale seems to have lost his ability to speak. Everyone's dripping in sweat, especially Castor and Pollux in their insect shells, and Cressida calls for a break. I scoop up handfuls of water from the lake, wishing I could dive in and surface alone and naked and unobserved. I wander around the perimeter for a while. When I come back around to the little concrete house beside the lake, I pause in the doorway and see Gale propping the crooked poker he salvaged against the wall by the hearth. For a moment, I have an image of a lone stranger, somewhere far in the future, wandering lost in the wilderness and coming upon this small place of refuge, with the pile of split logs, the hearth, the poker, wondering how it came to be. Gale turns and meets my eyes, and I know he's thinking about our last meeting here, when we fought over whether or not to run away. If we had, would District 12 still be there? I think it would. But the capital would still be in control of Panem as well. Cheese sandwiches are passed around, and we eat them in the shade of the trees. I intentionally sit at the far edge of the group next to Pollux, so I don't have to talk. No one's talking much, really. In the relative quiet, the birds take back the woods. I nudge Pollux with my elbow and point out a small black bird with a crown. It hops to a new branch, momentarily opening its wings, showing off its white patches. Pollux gestures to my pin and raises his eyebrows questioningly. I nod, confirming it's a mockingjay. I hold up one finger to say, "Wait, I'll show you," and whistle a bird call. The mockingjay cocks its head and whistles the call right back at me. Then, to my surprise, Pollux whistles a few notes of his own. The bird answers him immediately. Pollux's face breaks into an expression of delight, and he has a series of melodic exchanges with the mockingjay. My guess is it's the first conversation he's had in years. Music draws mockingjays like blossoms do bees, and in a short while he's got half a dozen of them perched in the branches over our heads. He taps me on the arm and uses a twig to write a word in the dirt. Sing? Usually I'd decline, but it's kind of impossible to say no to Pollux, given the circumstances. Besides, the mockingjay's song voices are different from their whistles, and I'd like him to hear them. So before I actually think about what I'm doing, I sing Rue's four notes, the ones she used to signal the end of the workday in 11. The notes that ended up as the background music to her murder. The birds don't know that. They pick up the simple phrase and bounce it back and forth between them in sweet harmony. Just as they did in the Hunger Games before the mutations broke through the trees, chased us onto the cornucopia, and slowly gnawed Cato to a bloody pulp. "Want to hear them do a real song?" I burst out. Anything to stop those memories. I'm on my feet, moving back into the trees, resting my hand on the rough trunk of a maple where the birds perch. I have not sung The Hanging Tree out loud for 10 years, because it's forbidden, but I remember every word. I begin softly, sweetly, as my father did. Are you coming to the tree where they strung up a man, they say murdered three? Strange things did happen here, no stranger would it be if we met up at midnight in the hanging tree.
The mockingjays begin to alter their songs as they become aware of my new offering.
Are you coming to the tree where the dead man called out for his love to flee? Strange things did happen here, no stranger would it be if we met up at midnight in the hanging tree.
I have the birds' attention now. In one more verse, surely they will have captured the melody, as it's simple and repeats four times with little variation.
Are you coming to the tree where I told you to run so we'd both be free? Strange things did happen here, no stranger would it be if we met up at midnight in the hanging tree.
A hush in the trees, just the rustle of leaves in the breeze, but no birds, mockingjay or other. Peter's right. They do fall silent when I sing, just as they did for my father.
Are you coming to the tree where a necklace of rope side by side with me? Strange things did happen here, no stranger would it be if we met up at midnight in the hanging tree.
The birds are waiting for me to continue, but that's it. Last verse. In the stillness, I remember the scene. I was home from a day in the woods with my father, sitting on the floor with Prim, who was just a toddler, singing The Hanging Tree. Making us necklaces out of scraps of old rope, like it said in the song, not knowing the real meaning of the words. The tune was simple and easy to harmonize to, though, and back then I could memorize almost anything set to music after a round or two. Suddenly, my mother snatched the rope necklaces away and was yelling at my father. I started to cry because my mother never yelled, and then Prim was wailing and I ran outside to hide. As I had exactly one hiding spot, in the meadow under a honeysuckle bush, my father found me immediately. He calmed me down and told me everything was fine. Only we'd better not sing that song anymore. My mother just wanted me to forget it, so, of course, every word was immediately, irrevocably branded into my brain. We didn't sing it any more, my father and me, or even speak of it. After he died, it used to come back to me a lot. Being older, I began to understand the lyrics. At the beginning, it sounds like a guy is trying to get his girlfriend to secretly meet up with him at midnight. But it's an odd place for a tryst, a hanging tree, where a man was hung for murder. The murderer's lover must have had something to do with the killing, or maybe they were just going to punish her anyway, because his corpse called out for her to flee. That's weird, obviously, the talking corpse bit, but it's not until the third verse that the hanging tree begins to get unnerving. You realize the singer of the song is the dead murderer. He's still in the hanging tree. And even though he told his lover to flee, he keeps asking if she's coming to meet him. The phrase, "where I told you to run so we'd both be free," is the most troubling, because at first you think he's talking about when he told her to flee, presumably to safety. But then you wonder if he meant for her to run to him, to death. In the final stanza, it's clear that that's what he's waiting for. His lover, with her rope necklace, hanging dead next to him in the tree. I used to think the murderer was the creepiest guy imaginable. Now, with a couple of trips to the Hunger Games under my belt, I decide not to judge him without knowing more details. Maybe his lover was already sentenced to death and he was trying to make it easier, to let her know he'd be waiting, or maybe he thought the place he was leaving her was really worse than death. Didn't I want to kill Peeta with that syringe to save him from the capital? Was that really my only option? Probably not, but I couldn't think of another at the time. I guess my mother thought the whole thing was too twisted for a 7-year-old, though, especially one who made her own rope necklaces.
It wasn't like hanging was something that only happened in a story. Plenty of people were executed that way in 12. You can bet she didn't want me singing it in front of my music class. She probably wouldn't like me doing it here for Pollux, even. But at least I'm not. Wait, no, I'm wrong. As I glance sideways, I see Castor has been taping me. Everyone is watching me intently, and Pollux has tears running down his cheeks because no doubt my freaky song has dredged up some terrible incident in his life. Great, I sigh and lean back against the trunk. That's when the mockingjays begin their rendition of the hanging tree. In their mouths, it's quite beautiful. Conscious of being filmed, I stand quietly until I hear Cressida call, "Cut!" Plutarch crosses to me, laughing.
"Where do you come up with this stuff? No one would believe it if we made it up."
He throws an arm around me and kisses me on the top of my head with a loud smack.
"You're golden!"
"I wasn't doing it for the cameras," I say.
"Lucky they were on, then," he says. "Come on, everybody, back to town."
As we trudge back through the woods, we reach a boulder, and both Gale and I turn our heads in the same direction, like a pair of dogs catching a scent on the wind. Cressida notices and asks what lies that way. We admit, without acknowledging each other, it's our old hunting rendezvous place. She wants to see it, even after we tell her it's nothing, really. Nothing but a place where I was happy, I think. Our rock ledge overlooking the valley, perhaps a little less green than usual, but the blackberry bushes hang heavy with fruit. Here began countless days of hunting, and snaring, fishing, and gathering, roaming together through the woods, unloading our thoughts while we filled our game bags. This was the doorway to both sustenance and sanity, and we were each other's key. There's no District 12 to escape from now, no peacekeepers to trick, no hungry mouths to feed. The capital took away all of that, and I'm on the verge of losing Gale as well. The glue of mutual need that bonded us so tightly together for all those years is melting away. Dark patches, not light, show in the spaces between us. How can it be that today, in the face of 12's horrible demise, we are too angry to even speak to each other? Gale as good as lied to me. That was unacceptable, even if he was concerned about my well-being. His apology seemed genuine, though, and I threw it back in his face with an insult to make sure it stung. What is happening to us? Why are we always at odds now? It's all a muddle. But I somehow feel that if I went back to the root of our troubles, my actions would be at the heart of it. Do I really want to drive him away? My fingers encircle a blackberry and pluck it from its stem. I roll it gently between my thumb and forefinger. Suddenly, I turn to him and toss it in his direction.
"And may the odds," I say.
I throw it high, so he has plenty of time to decide whether to knock it aside or accept it. Gale's eyes train on me, not the berry. But at the last moment, he opens his mouth and catches it. He chews, swallows, and there's a long pause before he says, "Be ever in your favor." But he does say it. Cressida has us sit in the nook in the rocks, where it's impossible not to be touching, and coaxes us into talking about hunting. What drove us out into the woods, how we met, favorite moments. We thaw, begin to laugh a little, as we relate mishaps with bees and wild dogs and skunks. When the conversation turns to how it felt to translate our skill with weapons to the bombing in 8, I stop talking. Gale just says,
"Long overdue."
By the time we reach the town square, afternoon's sinking into evening. I take Cressida to the rubble of the bakery and ask her to film something. The only emotion I can muster is exhaustion. "Peter, this is your home," None of your family has been heard of since the bombing. 12 is gone. And you're calling for a ceasefire? I look across the emptiness. There's no one left to hear you.
As we stand before the lump of metal that was the gallows, Cressida asks if either of us has ever been tortured. In answer, Gale pulls off his shirt and turns his back to the camera. I stare at the lash marks and again hear the whistling of the whip, see his bloody figure hanging unconscious by his wrists.
I'm done, I announce. I'll meet you at the Victor's Village. Something for my mother.
I guess I walked here, but the next thing I'm conscious of is sitting on the floor in front of the kitchen cabinets of our house in the Victor's Village, meticulously lining ceramic jars and glass bottles into a box, placing clean cotton bandages between them to prevent breaking, wrapping bunches of dried flowers. Suddenly I remember the rose on my dresser. Was it real? If so, is it still up there? I have to resist the temptation to check. If it's there, it will only frighten me all over again. I hurry with my packing. When the cabinet's empty, I rise to find that Gale has materialized in my kitchen. It's disturbing how soundlessly he can appear. He's leaning on the table, his fingers spread wide against the wood grain. I set the box between us.
Remember, he asks, this is where you kissed me.
So the heavy dose of morphling administered after the whipping wasn't enough to erase that from his consciousness.
I didn't think you'd remember that, I say.
Have to be dead to forget. Maybe not even then, he tells me. Maybe I'll be like that man in the hanging tree, still waiting for an answer.
Gale, who I have never seen cry, has tears in his eyes. To keep them from spilling over, I reach forward and press my lips against his. We taste of heat, ashes, and misery. It's a surprising flavor for such a gentle kiss. He pulls away first and gives me a wry smile.
I knew you'd kiss me.
How? I say, because I didn't know myself.
Because I'm in pain, he says. That's the only way I get your attention.
He picks up the box.
Don't worry, Katniss. It'll pass.
He leaves before I can answer. I'm too weary to work through his latest charge. I spend the short ride back to 13 curled up in a seat, trying to ignore Plutarch going on about one of his favorite subjects, weapons mankind no longer has at its disposal. High-flying planes, military satellites, cell disintegrators, drones, biological weapons with expiration dates, brought down by the destruction of the atmosphere or lack of technological resources or moral squeamishness. You can hear the regret of a head game maker who can only dream of such toys, who must make do with hovercraft and land-to-land missiles and plain old guns. After dropping off my Mockingjay suit, I go straight to bed without eating. Even so, Prim has to shake me to get me up in the morning. After breakfast, I ignore my schedule and take a nap in the supply closet. When I come to, crawling out from between the boxes of chalk and pencils, it's dinner time again. I get an extra large portion of pea soup and am headed back to compartment E when Boggs intercepts me.
There's a meeting in command. Disregard your current schedule, he says.
Done, I say.
Did you follow it at all today? He asks in exasperation.
Who knows? I'm mentally disoriented. I hold up my wrist to show my medical bracelet and realize it's gone. See? I can't even remember they took my bracelet. Why do they want me in command? Did I miss something?
I think Cressida wants to show you the 12 propos, but I guess you'll see them when they air, he says.
That's what I need a schedule of, when the propos air, I say. He shoots me a look, but doesn't comment further.
People have crowded into command, but they've saved me a seat between Finnick and Plutarch. The screens are already up on the table, showing the regular capital feed.
"What's going on? Aren't we seeing the 12 propos?" I ask.
"Oh, no," says Plutarch. "I mean, possibly. I don't know exactly what footage Beatty plans to use."
"Beatty thinks he's found a way to break into the feed nationwide," says Finnick, "so that our propos will air in the capital, too. He's down working on it in special defense now. There's live programming tonight. Snow's making an appearance or something. I think it's starting."
The capital seal appears, underscored by the anthem. Then I'm staring directly into President Snow's snake eyes as he greets the nation. He seems barricaded behind his podium, but the white rose on his lapel is in full view. The camera pulls back to include PETA off to one side in front of a projected map of Panem. He's sitting in an elevated chair, his shoes supported by a metal rung. The foot of his prosthetic leg taps out a strange, irregular beat. Beads of sweat have broken through the layer of powder on his upper lip and forehead. But it's the look in his eyes, angry yet unfocused, that frightens me the most.
"He's worse," I whisper.
Finnick grasps my hand to give me an anchor, and I try to hang on. PETA begins to speak in a frustrated tone about the need for the ceasefire. He highlights the damage done to key infrastructure in various districts, and as he speaks, parts of the map light up, showing images of the destruction. A broken dam in 7, a derailed train with a pool of toxic waste spilling from the tank cars, a granary collapsing after a fire. All of these he attributes to rebel action.
Bam! Without warning, I'm suddenly on television, standing in the rubble of the bakery.
Plutarch jumps to his feet.
"He did it! Beatty broke in!"
The room's buzzing with reaction when PETA's back, distracted. He has seen me on the monitor. He tries to pick up his speech by moving on to the bombing of a water purification plant, when a clip of Finnick talking about Rue replaces him. And then the whole thing breaks down into a broadcast battle, as the Capitol tech masters try to fend off Beatty's attack. But they are unprepared, and Beatty, apparently anticipating he would not hold on to control, has an arsenal of 5 to 10 second clips to work with. We watch the official presentation deteriorate as it's peppered with choice shots from the propos. Plutarch's in spasms of delight, and most everybody is cheering Beatty on, but Finnick remains still and speechless beside me. I meet Haymitch's eyes from across the room and see my own dread mirrored back. The recognition that with every cheer, PETA slips even farther from our grasp. The capital seals back up, accompanied by a flat audio tone. This lasts about 20 seconds before Snow and PETA return. The set is in turmoil. We're hearing frantic exchanges from their booth. Snow plows forward, saying that clearly the rebels are now attempting to disrupt the dissemination of information they find incriminating. But both truth and justice will reign. The full broadcast will resume when security has been reinstated. He asks PETA if, given tonight's demonstration, he has any parting thoughts for Katniss Everdeen. At the mention of my name, PETA's face contorts in effort.
"Katniss, how do you think this will end? What will be left? No one is safe. Not in the capital, not in the districts. And you? In 13.
He inhales sharply, as if fighting for air. His eyes look insane.
"Dead by morning!"
Off camera, Snow orders.
"End it."
Beatty throws the whole thing into chaos by flashing a still shot of me standing in front of the hospital at 3-second intervals. But between the images, we are privy to the real-life action being played out on the set. PETA's attempt to continue speaking,
the camera knocked down to record the white-tiled floor, the scuffle of boots, the impact of the blow that's inseparable from Peeta's cry of pain, and his blood as it splatters the tiles. Part 2. The Assault. Chapter 10. The scream begins in my lower back and works its way up through my body, only to jam in my throat. I'm an AVOX mute, choking on my grief. Even if I could release the muscles in my neck, let the sound tear into space, would anyone notice it? The room's in an uproar. Questions and demands ring out as they try to decipher Peeta's words. And you, in 13, dead by morning. Yet no one is asking about the messenger whose blood has been replaced by static. A voice calls the others to attention.
Shut up!
Every pair of eyes falls on Haymitch.
It's not some big mystery. The boy's telling us we're about to be attacked. Here, in 13.
How would he have that information?
Why should we trust him? How do you know?
Haymitch gives a growl of frustration.
They're beating him bloody while we speak. What more do you need?
Katniss, help me out here.
I have to give myself a shake to free my words. Haymitch is right. I don't know where Peeta got the information or if it's true. But he believes it is. And there... I can't say aloud what Snow's doing to him.
You don't know him, Haymitch says to Coyne.
We do. Get your people ready.
The president doesn't seem alarmed, only somewhat perplexed by this turn in events. She mulls over the words, tapping one finger lightly on the rim of the control board in front of her. When she speaks, she addresses Haymitch in an even voice.
Of course, we have prepared for such a scenario, although we have decades of support for the assumption that further direct attacks on 13 would be counterproductive to the capital's cause. Nuclear missiles would release radiation into the atmosphere, with incalculable environmental results. Even routine bombing could badly damage our military compound, which we know they hope to regain. And of course, they invite a counterstrike. It is conceivable that, given our current alliance with the rebels, those would be viewed as acceptable risks.
You think so? Says Haymitch.
It's a shade too sincere, but the subtleties of irony are often wasted in 13.
I do, at any rate. We're overdue for a level 5 security drill, says Coyne. Let's proceed with the lockdown.
She begins to type rapidly on her keyboard, authorizing her decision. The moment she raises her head, it begins. There have been 2 low-level drills since I arrived in 13. I don't remember much about the first. I was in intensive care in the hospital, and I think the patients were exempted, as the complications of removing us for a practice drill outweighed the benefits. I was vaguely aware of a mechanical voice instructing people to congregate in yellow zones. During the second, a level 2 drill meant for minor crises, such as a temporary quarantine while citizens were tested for contagion during a flu outbreak, we were supposed to return to our living quarters. I stayed behind a pipe in the laundry room, ignored the pulsating beeps coming over the audio system, and watched a spider construct a web. Neither experience has prepared me for the wordless, eardrum-piercing, fear-inducing sirens that now permeate 13. There would be no disregarding this sound, which seems designed to throw the whole population into a frenzy. But this is 13, and that doesn't happen. Boggs guides Finnick and me out of command, along the hall to a doorway and onto a wide stairway. Streams of people are converging to form a river that flows only downward. No one shrieks or tries to push ahead. Even the children don't resist. We descend, flight after flight, speechless,
because no word could be heard above this sound. I look for my mother and Prim, but it's impossible to see anyone but those immediately around me. They're both working in the hospital tonight, though, so there's no way they can miss the drill. My ears pop and my eyes feel heavy. We are coal mine deep. The only plus is that the farther we retreat into the earth, the less shrill the sirens become. It's as if they were meant to physically drive us away from the surface, which I suppose they are. Groups of people begin to peel off into marked doorways, and still Boggs directs me downward, until finally the stairs end, at the edge of an enormous cavern. I start to walk straight in, and Boggs stops me, shows me that I must wave my schedule in front of a scanner so that I'm accounted for. No doubt the information's going to some computer somewhere to make sure no one's gone astray. The place seems unable to decide if it's natural or man-made. Certain areas of the walls are stone, while steel beams and concrete heavily reinforce others. Sleeping bunks are hewn right into the rock walls. There's a kitchen, bathrooms, a first aid station. This place was designed for an extended stay. White signs with letters or numbers are placed at intervals around the cavern. As Boggs tells Finnick and me to report to the area that matches our assigned quarters, in my case E for compartment E, Plutarch strolls up.
"Ah, here you are," he says.
Recent events have had little effect on Plutarch's mood. He still has a happy glow from Beatty's success on the airtime assault, eyes on the forest, not on the trees, not on PETA's punishment or 13's imminent blasting.
"Katniss, obviously this is a bad moment for you, what with PETA's setback, but you need to be aware that others will be watching you."
"What?" I say. I can't believe he actually just downgraded PETA's dire circumstances to a setback.
"The other people in the bunker, they'll be taking their cue on how to react from you. If you're calm and brave, others will try to be as well. If you panic, it could spread like wildfire," explains Plutarch.
I just stare at him.
"Fire is catching, so to speak," he continues,
as if I'm being slow on the uptake.
"Why don't I just pretend I'm on camera, Plutarch?" I say.
"Yes, perfect. One is always much braver with an audience," he says. "Look at the courage PETA just displayed."
It's all I can do not to slap him.
"I've got to get back to COIN before lockdown. You keep up the good work," he says, and then heads off.
I cross to the big letter E posted on the wall. Our space consists of a 12-by-12-foot square of stone floor, delineated by painted lines. Carved into the wall are two bunks. One of us will be sleeping on the floor, and a ground-level cube space for storage. A piece of white paper, coated in clear plastic, reads, "Bunker Protocol." I stare fixedly at the little black specks on the sheet. For a while, they're obscured by the residual blood droplets that I can't seem to wipe from my vision. Slowly, the words come into focus. The first section is entitled, "On Arrival." 1. Make sure all members of your compartment are accounted for. My mother and Prim haven't arrived, but I was one of the first people to reach the bunker. Both of them are probably helping to relocate hospital patients. 2. Go to the supply station and secure one pack for each member of your compartment. Ready your living area? Return pack or packs. I scan the cavern until I locate the supply station. A deep room set off by a counter. People wait behind it, but there's not a lot of activity there yet. I walk over, give our compartment letter, and request 3 packs. A man checks a sheet, pulls the specified packs from shelving, and swings them up onto the counter. After sliding one on my back and getting a grip on the other two with my hands,
I turned to find a group rapidly forming behind me.
"Excuse me," I say as I carry my supplies through the others.
"Is it a matter of timing, or is Plutarch right? Are these people modeling their behavior on mine?"
Back at our space, I open one of the packs to find a thin mattress, bedding, two sets of gray clothing, a toothbrush, a comb, and a flashlight. On examining the contents of the other packs, I find the only discernible difference is that they contain both gray and white outfits. The latter will be for my mother and Prim, in case they have medical duties. After I make up the beds, store the clothes, and return the backpacks, I've got nothing to do but observe the last rule. 3. Await further instructions. I sit cross-legged on the floor to await. A steady flow of people begins to fill the room, claiming spaces, collecting supplies. It won't take long until the place is full up. I wonder if my mother and Prim are going to stay the night at wherever the hospital patients have been taken. But no, I don't think so. They were on the list here. I'm starting to get anxious when my mother appears. I look behind her into a sea of strangers. "Where's Prim?" I ask.
"Isn't she here?" she replies. "She was supposed to come straight down from the hospital. She left 10 minutes before I did. Where is she? Where could she have gone?"
I squeeze my lids shut tight for a moment to track her as I would prey on a hunt. See her react to the sirens, rush to help the patients, nod as they gesture for her to descend to the bunker, and then hesitate with her on the stairs. Torn for a moment. But why? My eyes fly open. The cat! She went back for him!
"Oh, no!"
my mother says. We both know I'm right. We're pushing against the incoming tide, trying to get out of the bunker. Up ahead, I can see them preparing to shut the thick metal doors, slowly rotating the metal wheels on either side inward. Somehow I know that once they have been sealed, nothing in the world will convince the soldiers to open them. Perhaps it will even be beyond their control. I'm indiscriminately shoving people aside as I shout for them to wait. The space between the doors shrinks to a yard, a foot. There are only a few inches left when I jam my hand through the crack. "Open it! Let me out!" I cry. Consternation shows on the soldiers' faces as they reverse the wheels a bit, not enough to let me pass, but enough to avoid crushing my fingers. I take the opportunity to wedge my shoulder into the opening. "Prim!" I holler up the stairs. My mother pleads with the guards as I try to wriggle my way out. "Prim!" Then I hear it, the faint sound of footsteps on the stairs.
"We're coming!"
I hear my sister call.
"Hold the door!"
That was Gail. "They're coming," I tell the guards, and they slide the doors open about a foot. But I don't dare move, afraid they'll lock us all out, until Prim appears, her cheeks flushed with running, hauling Buttercup. I pull her inside, and Gail follows, twisting an armload of baggage sideways to get it into the bunker. The doors are closed with a loud and final clank.
"What were you thinking?" I give Prim an angry shake and then hug her, squashing Buttercup between us.
Prim's explanation is already on her lips.
"I couldn't leave him behind, Katniss, not twice. You should have seen him pacing the room and howling. He'd come back to protect us."
"Okay, okay." I take a few breaths to calm myself, step back, and lift Buttercup by the scruff of the neck.
"I should have drowned you when I had the chance."
His ears flatten, and he raises a paw. I hiss before he gets a chance, which seems to annoy him a little, since he considers hissing his own personal sound of contempt. In retaliation, he gives a helpless kitten mew that brings my sister immediately to his defense.
"Oh, Katniss, don't tease him," she says, folding him back in her arms. "He's already so upset."
The idea that I've wounded the brute's tiny cat feelings just invites further taunting. But Prim's genuinely distressed for him. So instead, I visualize Buttercup's fur lining a pair of gloves, an image that has helped me deal with him over the years. Okay, sorry. We're under the big E on the wall. Better get him settled in before he loses it. Prim hurries off, and I find myself face to face with Gale. He's holding the box of medical supplies from our kitchen in 12. Sight of our last conversation. Kiss, fallout, whatever. My game bags slung across his shoulder. If PETA's right, these didn't stand a chance, he says. PETA, blood like raindrops on the window, like wet mud on boots. Thanks for everything. I take our stuff. What were you doing up in our rooms?
Just double-checking, he says. We're in 47 if you need me.
Practically everyone withdrew to their spaces when the doors shut, so I get to cross to our new home with at least 500 people watching me. I try to appear extra calm, to make up for my frantic crashing through the crowd. Like that's fooling anyone, so much for setting an example. Oh, who cares? They all think I'm nuts anyway. One man, who I think I knocked to the floor, catches my eye and rubs his elbow resentfully. I almost hiss at him, too. Prim has Buttercup installed on the lower bunk, draped in a blanket so that only his face pokes out. This is how he likes to be when there's thunder, the one thing that actually frightens him. My mother puts her box carefully in the cube. I crouch, my back supported by the wall, to check what Gale managed to rescue in my hunting bag. The plant book, the hunting jacket, my parents' wedding photo, and the personal contents of my drawer. My Mockingjay pin now lives with Cinna's outfit, but there's the gold locket and the silver parachute with the spile, and PETA's pearl. I knot it in the corner of the parachute, bury it deep in the recesses of the bag, as if it's PETA's life and no one can take it away as long as I guard it. The faint sound of the sirens cut off sharply. Coyne's voice comes over the district audio system, thanking us all for an exemplary evacuation of the upper levels. She stresses that this is not a drill, as PETA Mellark, the District 12 victor, has possibly made a televised reference to an attack on 13 tonight. That's when the first bomb hits. There's an initial sense of impact, followed by an explosion that resonates in my innermost parts. The lining of my intestines, the marrow of my bones, the roots of my teeth. We're all going to die, I think. My eyes turn upward, expecting to see giant cracks race across the ceiling, massive chunks of stone raining down on us. But the bunker itself gives only a slight shudder. The lights go out, and I experience the disorientation of total darkness. Speechless human sounds, spontaneous shrieks, ragged breaths, baby whimpers, one musical bit of insane laughter dance around in the charged air. Then there's a hum of a generator, and a dim wavering glow replaces the stark lighting that is the norm in 13. It's closer to what we had in our homes in 12, when the candles and fire burned low on a winter's night. I reach for Prim in the twilight, clamp my hand on her leg, and pull myself over to her. Her voice remains steady as she croons to Buttercup.
It's all right, baby. It's all right. We'll be okay down here.
My mother wraps her arms around us. I allow myself to feel young for a moment and rest my head on her shoulder.
That was nothing like the bombs in 8, I say.
Probably a bunker missile, says Prim, keeping her voice soothing for the cat's sake. We learned about them during the orientation for new citizens. They're designed to penetrate deep in the ground before they go off, because there's no point in bombing 13 on the surface anymore.
Nuclear? I ask, feeling a chill run through me.
Not necessarily, says Prim. Some just have a lot of explosives in them. But
It could be either kind, I guess.
The gloom makes it hard to see the heavy metal doors at the end of the bunker. Would they be any protection against a nuclear attack? And even if they were 100% effective at sealing out the radiation, which is really unlikely, would we ever be able to leave this place? The thought of spending whatever remains of my life in this stone vault horrifies me. I want to run madly for the door and demand to be released into whatever lies above. It's pointless. They would never let me out. And I might start some kind of stampede.
We're so far down, I'm sure we're safe, says my mother wanly.
Is she thinking of my father's being blown to nothingness in the mines?
It was a close call, though. Thank goodness Peter had the wherewithal to warn us.
The wherewithal, a general term that somehow includes everything that was needed for him to sound the alarm. The knowledge, the opportunity, the courage, and something else I can't define. Peter seemed to have been waging a sort of battle in his mind, fighting to get the message out. Why? The ease with which he manipulates words is his greatest talent. Was his difficulty a result of his torture? Something more? Like madness?
Coyne's voice, perhaps a shade grimmer, fills the bunker, the volume level flickering with the lights.
Apparently, Peter Mallark's information was sound, and we owe him a great debt of gratitude. Sensors indicate the first missile was not nuclear, but very powerful. We expect more will follow. For the duration of the attack, citizens are to stay in their assigned areas unless otherwise notified.
A soldier alerts my mother that she's needed in the first aid station. She's reluctant to leave us, even though she'll only be 30 yards away.
We'll be fine, really, I tell her.
Do you think anything could get past him?
I point to Buttercup, who gives me such a half-hearted hiss. We all have to laugh a little. Even I feel sorry for him. After my mother goes, I suggest,
why don't you climb in with him, Prim?
I know, it's silly, but I'm afraid the bunk might collapse on us during the attack, she says.
If the bunks collapse, the whole bunker will have given way and buried us, but I decide this kind of logic won't actually be helpful. Instead, I clean out the storage cube and make Buttercup a bed inside. Then I pull a mattress in front of it for me and my sister to share. We're given clearance in small groups to use the bathroom and brush our teeth, although showering has been cancelled for the day. I curl up with Prim on the mattress, double layering the blankets because the cavern emits a dank chill. Buttercup, miserable even with Prim,